sometimes delayed for quite a while, and you're trying to shorten that gap up, but you couldn't make any change, because you didn't know what to do.
Exactly, so it's kind of a catch-22 where we are now, and this will make it more workable.
Nancy, lines 29 and 30.
And did we decide that the employer was going to make the decision about...
We haven't gone back to that.
Good.
We'll see if our committee is stabilized for a few minutes.
Work fast.
Well, why don't we go back to that one?
All right. All the players are on stage.
Since Mr. Lemon is up there.
Mr. Chairman, Bill Lemon, Department of Higher Education.
We're going back to page 3, lines 22.
If you will look carefully at the language as it now exists, in other words, ignoring the bold print, it now says, "No person enrolled full-time or part-time in a state institution may become a member of the system." And that's the thing that you were trying to avoid by saying, well, what if a person is employed full-time and takes a course? Right now, the law says you can't be a member of the system if you're enrolled part-time or full-time. And so this is an attempt to clarify the matter so that if a person is principally a student, meaning that they're enrolled full-time as a student and work part-time, they're not a member of the system. If they're hired full-time and take a course or two courses, which is the maximum we allow under the staff fee arrangement, then that person is not principally a student, but principally an employee. Now, I grant you, if someone is working for the nursing home or whatever it was you're talking about down the street...
Well, let's say that they're a maintenance employee in a state institution, working full-time, and they now want to, at the same time, enroll full-time as a student.
Then we would have to make a determination as to which they were principally, and I assume that...
How would you decide?
I don't know at the moment, because we're really, this is focused primarily on people who are employed by an institution of higher education. There may well be some people who are enrolled full-time and who are also full-time state employees, but as you know, that's in the main, a small minority of people. So we would again have to...
We have had many students who are working full-time on a job outside of the institution and at the same time enrolled full-time as students. And I don't understand why we would make a distinction between those people and those people who happen to have their full-time job in an institution.
Mr. Chairman, the attempt here is to avoid the necessity of forbidding people who are enrolled at all in the system of higher education from being a member of PERS. That's what the existing language says. No inmate of an institution, no person enrolled full-time or part-time in a state institution, and then skip to line 25, may become a member of the system. That's what the present law says.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Bill, if you retain that language, that amendment does nothing for you other than what is already being done, because you're retaining no student, no person enrolled full or part-time in a state institution principally as a student.
Principally as a student, meaning that that is the dominant occupation, if I can use that term, of the individual, is that of a student rather than employee. I assume that if a person were employed at another state agency, in the example the chair gave, that we could determine that that person was primarily not a student but an employee because they're engaged full-time. Our own people who are working full-time, as I say, are usually limited to two courses so that they're not...
We understand that's usually the case, and there's no problem, but we're talking about the exceptional case. I guess the thing that sticks me is in my years of teaching at Portland State, I knew many students who were employed full-time.
That's correct.
And were at the same time full-time students.
That's correct.
And this would exclude those people if they happened to be employed at the institution from being members of PERS.
Well, Chairman, I, some of the examples I know from the past too, experiences, you have a master's degree student who signs up for 3 hours during the summer for thesis, but is working full-time in a, let's say, Forest Products laboratory, is being paid really a full salary to do the work, and yet, and maybe one of these days becomes a instructor in the system, they never get back to pick up those months that they worked under PRS. They basically are.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Leet, they would not be able, to do that under any circumstances, because unless they were employed 600 hours.
Nobody will believe that.
They're just in the summer, they don't qualify in the first place, because they would not, in all probability, have worked the necessary 600 hours in order to get membership in the first place.
So what if they stayed out 2 terms, Bill? Could they do it?
Then they could qualify, if they were out 2 terms working full-time. For the state or an organization that was a member of PRS, then they could, of course, qualify.
Well, I personally would like to see if we could get this language rewritten.
All right.
So that it does not, the purpose, obviously, is that if the person is employed because of their status as a student, it would seem legitimate that they not be members of PRS, work study student. But if that's their full-time employment, and that full-time employment is not dependent upon them being students, but they have to be full-time students, then I don't think they should be excluded. I think we could get some language like that.
We will make every effort to do so.
Thank you. I think that's all we want.
Before Bill leaves, and I don't mean to skip ahead, but do you see anything in here that is going to be a detriment to sick leave accumulation and being counted as retirement for employees in the language that's being proposed on page 5? Seems to me like the only thing it does is take care of Hillcrest and McLean.
Yes, we don't see any detriment.
Okay.
Yes, the answer is no.
Representative Burton?
Well, just go back to page 3 for a second. But an inmate of a state institution? Are you sure we don't want to include in there someone who is principally an inmate?
Whatever. I think the language was not too well.
Truly evil.
That would be us, I guess.
Right, yes.
All right, let's see, we're...
So I wonder if that excludes legislators. We're principally inmates of an institution.
Certifiable.
Are we on page 8 now? I think so. On lines 30 and 31. Well, we did that.
But no, it's essentially the same thing, Mr. Chairman. It's what there was on section 7, except this is dealing again with the establishment of a beneficiary as well as the option. Same type of liberalization.
All right, page 9.
Page 9. If we're looking on line 17, 21, well, 17 is a clarifying statement from death to disbursement of the payment is payable. Date of disbursement rather than date of death gives clarity there. Line 21 is essentially the same type of thing as we just discussed previously. It liberalizes the time when that change could be made. Lines 36 through 40, antiquated language. We don't have anybody that's going to pay anything back before December 31, 1953 today. If I may take you to page 10.
This the dumb statement, why not? I mean, is there no one?
Because it has to be paid before December 31, 1953.
Before that.
Before that. So it's just antiquated language we need to clean out. Page 10. This is a takeoff or an expansion on what we did in the 87 session, wherein at that time, if an individual's benefit was going to be less than $30, it was a lump sum, and now we've expanded that to include those monthly payments that may be derived from death benefits. And the language on page 10 And again, the language on page 11, lines 41 and 42, are dealing with the minimum benefit paid under death benefits. So if it is less than $30, instead of having a $2 payment going out every month or a 38-cent benefit, because we have multiple beneficiaries, we can make it one lump sum if it's less than $30.
There's a substantial savings to the system on that, isn't there?
Administratively, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Have you got a figure on that?
No, sir, I do not.
When we tally up the scorecard in the sky, we want to...
I do not. It would take the burden, Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Cleve, it would take the burden off of some of the other things that we need to get done.
Well, I remember that one time, that was fairly sizable until we adjusted it last time. And it should be another little bit of an increase in savings here.
If I may take you to page 13. This again is that liberalization of when that designated beneficiary can be made, the change.
This one actually tightens it though, doesn't it?
Anytime before the first payment is normally due again, sir, and we've changed that to 60 days after the date of the first payment.
Oh, I see, 60 days after the first payment. Okay. Thank you.
Number 14 on lines 11 through 22. Again, it is language that has become obsolete. We do not need it. Individuals fitting into this category would be treated as though not retired, and then we would go back to ORS 237-169. So it's just a superfluous language and no longer needed. If I may take you to number 16. Line 20 and 21. That one, again, is a liberalization of when you can make an election as to what to do with that variable annuity account at retirement. And it liberalizes that to 60 days when normally due versus 60 days the first payment. So it liberalizes that one. And then on line 22, it deletes the limitation of adjusting the benefit payable from a variable annuity account if a person elects to participate in that. It eliminates the limitation of a 2%. So an adjustment could be made.
What line did you say that was?
Beg pardon? I'm sorry, line 32, sir.
32.
Okay.
It's too bad we couldn't eliminate another 2% somewhere.
It just eliminates that,
that language.
The variable is slightly under 2%. There may be reason for the board to make an adjustment. This would preclude the board from being able to do it as it is written today. We're suggesting that we take out that 2% to give the board the chance to make those adjustments. Now, this is not the cost of living adjustment. This is what the variable has done from 1 year to the next. If it is less than 2%, by deleting that those words on 32, the board could adjust that benefit. Line 7 or page 17, lines 37 through 44 is strengthening language and solidifying language, if I may, that may not be a good term, in our contact with the employers to assure timely collection of contributions and the submission of reports that we need in order to get that. And that actually, that amendment carries on over to page 18, lines 1 through 7, wherein we then, the penalties that we would impose, we do cap those at $2,000. So we can get the employer's attention, but it would not be an unreasonable. As it is now, today, the penalty we may charge is 1% per month or a fraction thereof that an employer is late in remitting contributions. And for a large employer, that can be a substantial penalty for a month or two. This would cap it.
Mr. Chair, it looks like that's basically directed at the sending in the contribution of that employee. But what about the agency that doesn't get you timely information for calculating an employee's retirement? Is there a penalty on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Fleet, yes, that's part and parcel in subsection five on lines 1 through 7 on page 18. Speaks about making reports and supplying information. Any public employer delinquent in making reports or supplying information concerning its employees.
Okay, so that'll cover that particular case.
Correct.
In case some agency doesn't get you the stuff on time.
That's correct.
So you can lower the boom on them so that you're not getting blamed for holding up the payments.
Senator Trill?
And I think that's really a good idea, but if the shoe fits well on that foot, it ought to fit well on the other foot, too. And there's been just unconscionable delays of getting monies to beneficiaries who deserve monies. Either they've retired and to getting the money to them, starting the payments, or there's some need for a recomputation of what they have. And the delays are tremendous. And while you delay, not only do you not send them the money, and so nothing's coming in for them, but you never pay them any interest on the monies that they eventually get. It is true, eventually you send them the money that they didn't get, but you don't pay any interest on that while you're holding it. And so I'd like to know, how in the blazes can we speed it up so beneficiaries don't have to wait months and months and months to get a check?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trill, I think we have and are addressing that through this session.
Well, I hope so, but I've been talking about this more sessions than this one.
Understood, and I know very clearly where you're coming from on that, if I may, Senator. But our budget bill, coupled together with, I believe, House Bill 2987, which gives us some very specific statutory direction of when we shall pay benefits.
Why don't you pay them some interest on the money that they don't get? That way you'll make sure you do it.
All right. I don't know if we can slip that in, but we'll make a note on that one.
But I think that would be a real incentive for you to get the checks off to them if you have to pay interest on the money if you don't get it to them. All right.
Would you backtrack to page 17 and explain to me the difference between the new subsection 3 and the subsection 4?
I'll try, Mr. Chairman. Subsection 3 is dealing with any state officer or state agency, and subsection 4 is dealing with any public employer.
Okay, that's the difference.
Right, sir.
All right. Thank you.
School district versus, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On that line, the penalty is only against other public employers, not against the state, obviously. I mean, the fine if you're hitting the foot. Fire department or a school district out there fails to comply with subsection 5, and they're subject to being penalized by a fine. But if it's a state agency, they're not subject to being penalized.
Yeah, there's no penalty.
I know, but
their
I'm just wondering.
Is withheld.
We just withhold it through certification in subsections 4, subsection 3.
The state agencies, are they chronically late with stuff? You have problems with state agencies?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Trill, I don't think that's fair to say that. I think there are problems with all public employers, whether state agencies or some of our other political subdivisions. It's not unique to the state. They're not without problems, but there are problems that we do occur with other public employers.
Okay.
Have you not been charging a penalty before?
Yes, we have.
You have.
Page 18, section 10. Line number 9 gives clarity as to which statute we would look at were we to go out I do not claim to be a lawyer, but I think it amounts to basically a writ of mandamus to be able to get materials, records, contributions, etc. It gives the proper paragraph that we use for a citation on that. If I may, section 11 on page 18, I have submitted to committee staff a suggested conflict amendment for sections 11 and 12. The reason for this is sections 237, ORIS 237.320 and ORS 237.325 have previously been amended by the Senate Bill 1193, which is now awaiting the governor's signature. And being somewhat new to this arena, I believe this is the conflict amendment, as I understand it, is the way to provide consistency in our legislation and not create, again, conflict. We are asking in that conflict amendment, if I may take you down to line 32 on page 18, for the simplification of administration, and I think the intent of the original legislation, we're suggesting that it be surviving spouse or dependent, not beneficiary. A beneficiary could be, you know, most anything out there that we would have to provide an insurance coverage for. We're saying for the spouse and dependents of that retiree. And we recommend that in this bill. The second part on section 12, page 20 of...
obviously, under the Constitution, we've got to, if we're going to adopt the amendment you propose to 1193, we would have to lay out the whole section.
I cannot respond to that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that's what we have to do. The Constitution says you can't amend something unless you lay out the whole section you're amending. So, but the language used in 1193 was beneficiary, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you, your people didn't see that when 1193 was going through and proposed that change.
I'm going to have to agree with you on that, sir.
I think at least the members of the Senate have heard me harangue on conflict amendments.
Yes.
And frankly, I don't see any reason for the conflict amendment, because the Constitution says that if a bill is passed and a subsequent bill amends the same section, legislative council is authorized to resolve the conflict so as to reflect the intent of the bills. And I would say that if we were to adopt 2049 with the new language on line 32 of 18, that would supersede the language that was in Senate Bill 1193.
Does it make any difference which passes last? Which passes?
No, it doesn't.
First? Doesn't.
As long as the if there is a conflict in intent between the two bills, then the one that passes last has the effect. But if there is no conflict, but they just happen to amend the same section, but affecting different things in that section, then both of the changes in the section are adopted under the Constitution. And it just infuriates me that legislative council has refused. We went to all the trouble to amend the Constitution, and they've refused to use it. So I would say we have no reason for this particular conflict amendment, especially when this is the second bill passing.
Hey, so my question here is a little broader, and I apologize for not knowing more about these laws or in having missed the meetings, but this section basically, in that particular piece, is definitions.
We ought to check that out with legislative council.
And we're defining here the meaning of eligible person. My question is, eligible for what?
I don't know. Ask Frank.
Eligible to enroll in one of the health insurance coverages sponsored by the system, sir.
So everybody that's in these also has to be eligible for federal Medicare in the first place. So it's a, if I'm reading all these also have to be eligible. The requirement is to be a person who has a surviving spouse or dependent who could be indeed a, an adult dependent who is also eligible for federal Medicare. Is that right?
That'd be correct, sir.
All right. We're going, I'm informed that not only does the House conflict with this meeting, but another subcommittee conflicts with it in that it is supposed to come in here at 3 o'clock.
That is that mob outside their mind to be with.
That's probably it. It's capital construction.
Is that yours?
We can quickly go through.
We can delay, I can just, we can hold, go ahead, move through the rest of this bill if you want to. They've been waiting for some time.
Let me ask on line 41, page 18. A retired eligible member, I presume, now that the eligible has been redefined, would be a surviving spouse or dependent. What would that be now?
Well, again, I'm trying to remember, if I may, Mr. Chairman, what has actually been amended, because that, those, this whole area has been substantially amended by 1193.
I see.
And I'm trying to remember what it is we're dealing with now, and I do not have that with me readily handy, so I'm going to have to say, I don't know.
All right, let's, we ought to get that bill in here and look at this then, and see what's involved there.
The whole of subsection B there has all been changed by 1193.
Because that's one of those cases in which the change up on line 32 may make some significant changes in the other bill.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, 1193, I think you'll find, has simplified all of these uppercase A, B, C. It simplified that considerably and brought it down into more, much more readable and understandable language. The last section is section 12, and again, with the same concern you expressed on the previous one, the possibility of needing a conflict amendment or not, and I offer to the chair on that. On line number 6, page 20, Senate Bill 1193 did not have the term qualifying service. It kept the old language of creditable service. Qualifying service was brought in as a dash 2 amendment or a dash 3 amendment, I don't remember exactly which, to 2049 after the other things got to moving. And what this is it tends to liberalize the time required of an individual to be eligible for the Medicare supplement. Instead of 8.5 years of employment, it would make it 8 years of employment. Right now, creditable service means the service we use in computing a benefit, which excludes the first 6 months. This would say if an individual has been in a qualifying position, and then language down on lines 19 and 22 give clarity to what we mean by qualifying. It is intended to give 6 months additional liberalization. Now, whether that requires a conflict or whether it could stand as has been submitted here on page 20, that's what it's attempting to do through the dash 2 amendments that were introduced.
Okay, when we get back to this one, I'll try to confer with people and with legislative counsel on this.
Why don't you let that rock on the fact that if they buy back their 6 months, then count it. If they don't buy their 6 months back, then you go to the 8 years.
To be able to purchase, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Van Fleet, to be able to purchase the 6 months creditable service takes 10 years of creditable service under the retirement system. Today, we allow a person with 8 years of creditable service to be entitled to the subsidy.
I see.
So the purchase is a moot issue. That's right.
Mr. Chair, I think the issue of conflict amendments is one that would be nice to have legislative council come and dialogue with you in front of us as to.
No, that's what I said, I wanted to have.
Because if you're right, they're having us do a lot of extra work.
Well, I know they are, I've protested nearly every time we've done it.
Chair, just a real quick general question.
Yeah.
Are any of these changes been precipitated by lawsuits being brought?
Probably the Webster.
Not that I am aware of, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton, I'm not aware that any of these are directly precipitous of a lawsuit that I can recall, that I know of at this point.
We have, why don't we see if we can add to tomorrow's agenda? Yes, oh, tomorrow's the education. Okay. Next meeting of this, this salary sub, we'll continue the discussion of the bills we haven't finished yet on PERS. Tomorrow, we're in education, and we've got a couple of little education bills that aren't going to take too much time.
So I'll put all the rest that we didn't get to on Saturday, and the ones we didn't get to today.
Yes.
And see if council can talk about conflict amendments.
Okay. Subcommittee's adjourned. Sorry to keep you all here listening to this exciting conversation.
11:00.